In choosing to focus his most recent book on water, literally and figuratively, Bill Conlaw goes beyond providing readers with information about the fundamental element that water is, and beyond relating historical stories about water in this region. He's actually written a book that is structured in some sense in the varied ways water behaves. He tells us it's a fluid history, one that traces transformations. This book meanders in its flow, as he describes it. He tells us, I use meander and flow because their senses overlap. As a noun, meander means a winding path, especially a labyrinth. As a verb, it is to follow an intricate course and to wander casually with no pressing destination. The word's origin, the meander, a river in present-day Turkey, follows a crooked path to the sea, long after it abandoned its ancient port city. Flow comes from the Old English, which is akin to the Old High German, to rinse or wash. The word has roots in the Latin, to rain, and the Greek, to sail. The English word means to issue or move in a stream, circulate, to derive from a source. Conlaug says, I wrote Working Watersheds as an historical and literary narrative. The book includes not only historical storytelling and literary analysis, but also first-person anecdotes, maps, a timeline, and a glossary of coal mining terms. I braid these together to capture the interconnections of reality. Working Watersheds is a complex text, one that I invite you to weave with me. Working Watersheds, full title is Working Watersheds, Water and Energy in the Lackawanna Valley. As we'll learn, it can't be categorized as an example of merely STEM thinking, you know, the acronym for science, technology, engineering, and mathematics. Those disciplines are all fundamental to Dr. Conlaug's considerations, and they are here. But STEAM is more apt, adding the A for the arts. And even though we'll encounter numbers as needed, we should perhaps switch the M from mathematics to M for mythology. Bill Conlaug has taught English at the university level for a number of years, and he is the author of Undermined in Coal Country, On the Measures in a Working Land. Here and There, Reading Pennsylvania's Working Landscapes, and Working the Garden, American Writers and the Industrialization of Agriculture. In anticipation of Earth Day 2025, Dr. Conlaug paid a visit to the WVIA Benko studio to talk with us about his newest book, Working Watersheds, issued by Temple University Press. He spoke about the book and its inspiration.
Well, I've always been interested in land use, two kinds of land use, farming and mining. So I wrote a book a few years ago that talked about both of those. And in there, I discussed the Lackawanna River a little bit, and I always thought that it would be a good idea to write a book that would focus in a large part on the river, and then more broadly on water in the Lackawanna Valley.
I wanted to ask if you wouldn't start with the epigraph you used from John Gardner, who was also tied to Pennsylvania, about the two eyes.
The troll said, the secret is, watch with both eyes. That is a quote from his book on moral fiction. And I always found that to be a fascinating quote because it is related to Norse mythology. And this idea of watching with both eyes is, for me, about paying close attention, seeing in depth, because if you're only looking with one eye, you're only seeing surfaces, really, and not the full dimensions. So for me, local and global, history and literature, near and far, all of those are the two eyes that I try to look through in writing this book.
One of the things that's so important in terms of all those things you just mentioned is that it's not either or, You help us see the complexity and the paradoxes in living in a world today. The idea is it's not just a return to the past when we recover something or make sure that something's been revitalized, but you talk about it as a new situation.
Right, as a going beyond, moving into the future without necessarily going back into the past, though using the past as a guide for understanding how we can cope with the losses and gains of what we've done with the land and with water. I think in a lot of ways it's about the resilience of the river, because the river has recovered in many places to be a trout stream that attracts people from all over the world. And it's below the Old Forge borehole where we see some damage still taking place because of all that toxic water that's pouring into the river there every day. Though even in that stretch of the river, those last 3 miles, it's no longer acidic. It's alkaline, and life is beginning to return there, though it still looks like it's a disaster.
Tell us about digging anthracite from the river, scooping up anthracite from the river. How did it figure into the overall mining picture?
Yeah, there was, on the Susquehanna River especially, there was a mining industry 100 and some years ago where dredgers would dredge the river for a coal and then sell it to power companies or to schools for use. And as far down as Harrisburg and below, they were pulling large amounts of coal from the river. And that was something that continued. The last person who was doing this ended his work in 1996, I believe. And a lot of coal had just piled up against islands in the river, and then against the Holtwood Dam further south. And then even in the Lackawanna, there was a dam near the iron furnaces where coal had collected from the work there, and they dredged that and used that in the iron furnaces.
You mentioned dams in the course of your narrative, and we hear a lot today about the struggle for control of the sources of water in the western United States. Where is it going to come from and who's going to control it? Mm-hmm. But you mentioned in the late 19th century there were conflicts around who was going to control the water sources here.
Yeah, there were big conflicts among the major water companies in the region over control of, for example, parts of the Lehigh River and the Lackawanna, especially around Stillwater, the water dam. And a lot of that, in my telling of it, was driven by a drought in 1895. So coal companies needed water for their operations. Of course, towns and the cities needed water for their populations. So there was a real tension between those two separate uses. And then, of course, the water companies were supplying both in many cases. And a lot of these water companies were controlled by coal operators. So there was that history of tension between them and competition for mining.
And you do bring up the topic of textiles, and we may not even think about the water use in the textile industry in those times.
Well, my understanding is that textile mills had to keep a certain level of water in the air, the humidity, so that threads wouldn't break. They were very hot, very humid places. And then, too, they used a lot of water in dyeing materials. And then all that waste, of course, would end up in the river. So those were the two major uses there.
Where did the various impulses come from to do that reclamation work for the watershed and the waterways?
Well, I think after the beginning of construction of sewer systems and sewage treatment systems in the late 60s, early 70s in the valley, people began to turn to the river to clean up the rest of it. There were groups that were active in doing the best they could to help the river along to recover. And then in 1987, I believe it was the Lackawanna River Corridor Association that was founded. And, of course, they were able to connect with the National Park Service and other organizations and get professional help in to the region to do more extensive cleanups along the river. And that, of course, is continuing today. A major figure in that was Bernie McGrill, as you know, and then Tara Jones is now director of LRCA. And they've even changed their name about 7 or 8 years ago to the Lackawanna River Conservation Association to acknowledge that it's not just the river that we should be paying attention to, but the watershed as a whole. So that's an example of widening one's vision, seeing that this one waterway is not isolated it's connected to the watershed, but then that watershed is connected to other watersheds, and then so on.
And that's a lesson we all had to learn and need to learn, that we all live downstream.
Yeah. And of course, the river was polluted because industries and towns and cities wanted their waste to just go away. And as long as it wasn't around them, they were fine. But of course, it all runs downstream. And then the Lackawanna had been long, and still is in many ways, a source of pollution for not just the Susquehanna, but Chesapeake Bay. So those waters are tied directly to what we're doing in our backyards.
I always love the story you tell about taking your students to the iron furnaces and reading the Merwin poem.
The Drunk in the Furnace.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But you spend time with Merwin and his poem Lackawanna and help us understand how he saw and how he expressed his sense of the river.
Yeah, he uses the river as a way to talk about its pollution and how he was warned away from it as a child. But then at another level, he's talking about the river as a metaphor for time and for flow of history, and how he as a child ends up jumping with both feet into the river. And that's his moment of awakening and awareness of the passage of time, his own mortality, and the presence of death, and all that history brings with it, once you begin to connect the dots and think through how we got to where we are.
You talk to us in the narrative, and you write in this way, about history and the linear telling, chronological telling of events, but also the sense that history and our lives are cyclical as well. And that's a big concept. That's philosophical.
Right. And that's one of my hopes in the book, is to lead people to think that things are often in cycles as much as they are in linear terms, that reality is multi-layered, and how we understand things is often returned to what we knew before to move forward, and that the use of water as a metaphor to represent that, I think, is fascinating.
And you have another water poem, The River, by Paul Kelly, that gets to that wonderful sense of seeing with both eyes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because that poem, you see the adult perspective and the child perspective and how they're in tension with each other, and that the adult is distancing himself from the river while the child is up close and personal with the river and playing baseball next to the river and then conforming the rules of the game to accommodate the river. So I wanted to use that poem for those reasons, but then too, to include local voices in the book, in addition to more famous voices. Merwin is perfect because he's both local and famous.
How did you create, craft, structure this book with two eyes?
Well, I've always been interested in history and literature, so they've always been my guidepost for understanding what's out there beyond me. And I wanted to see how I could understand the region through those two lenses at the same time. And talking about water was a way to see how those two things can come together in different places, different times, in different ways. And that I think literature and history are foundational for our understanding of ourselves, just as water is foundational for our very survival. So meshing those together, I just wanted to see what would happen, and this book is what happened.
And you cite a novel that is set in the context of fracking, but not from here, but Western Pennsylvania.
Yes, Heat and Light. It's a great novel. I would recommend it. And a lot of the things that are alluded to in that novel are things that either happen in this region or are directly analogous to what's going on in the world of the novel and what's happened elsewhere in the state. So it's a way for people unfamiliar with the issues that surround natural gas drilling to have access to them. Issues related to water, issues related to wildlife and drinking water, what they do with the wastewater, how the systems work, and then how community members react to the presence of natural gas drilling in their regions.
And climate change, you help us find a way to think about climate change.
Yeah, I'm hoping that the book helps people to understand that climate change is an issue and that it has so many different and various effects on our everyday lives, and that these effects will begin to occur more frequently as we get deeper into the warming of the atmosphere.
When we're talking about a worldview, a way that we as humans have made sense of the world in which we live, what about the indigenous peoples and their perspective on water? Can we learn from that?
Definitely, I think so. The people who are indigenous to North America had a longstanding relationship with the land and with water, and that their civilizations had lasted thousands of years before Europeans arrived. So Euro-Americans are recent arrivals. So we're still, as Euro-Americans, trying to understand this space. So those who have long lived in the region have something to say that can help us all to live with the land in ways that are less damaging, live with water in ways that are less polluting, and that can teach us how to live with each other in less harmful ways.
I get the sense, and you say, don't you, that we can learn from the water itself or the river itself. It's a conversation rather than a one-way street.
Yeah, water, interestingly, is a shapeshifter because it's a gas, water vapor. It's obviously a liquid, and then it's a solid when it freezes. So it moves through different forms, and that is a metaphor for remaking, and we can remake ourselves. And we are, of course, composed mostly of water when you think about it.
You tell us why you think poetry is, just in general, something that's important for us. So I ask you, on one level, is it in that sense that poetry is important for us to help us break through our habitual ways of seeing things? And then what about the words that we use that can obscure, obfuscate what we're really talking about when we're talking about the region and the damage and all those sorts of things?
Yeah, our use of language is so important in understanding what we're looking at, because we use language often to define things, to understand not just what we're looking at, but how we can imagine ways to move beyond damage, for example. And poetry is the highest, I think, expression of our uses of language, and it forces us to pay attention to the language that we're using, because poets are wonderful in having so many things going on at the same time and expressing so many ideas at once, that they lead us to then take that attention into our everyday lives when we're thinking about what someone is offering us in our everyday language.
Also, you help us remember that we have a way of making sense of the world, telling stories, passing stories on, rooted so often in mythology, myth. You mentioned Thor, for example.
Yeah, I think myth is something we should be paying attention to, because it is echoing our origins as a species in a lot of ways. And we keep returning to those stories because they do that for us. They touch us at some unconscious level often, I think. And that we need a mythical, I guess, understanding of ourselves. And we need heroes, and we need to be in touch with the elemental forces that surround us. And myth is one way that that happens, I think.
In the course of his study, Bill Conlogue defines the word flow as a key for his work. He writes, here, flow means to deform under stress without cracking or fracturing, used mainly of minerals and rocks, but is just as helpful in thinking about people and places. About survival and adaptation, flow sums up the aftermath of mining in the Lackawanna Valley, which has been disfigured but not cracked, at least not completely. The pressures of climate and energy change will likely deform it further. How individuals and communities cope will determine whether they shatter. Given the grip of global warming, maintaining local flow may be the most positive possibility. If changing form is survival, then defending human integrity and dignity in the Anthropocene will be about learning how to build lives, communities, and infrastructures that won't crack or split under stress. And that is what Bill Conlogue is hoping for his new book titled Working Watersheds, Water and Energy in the Lackawanna Valley, issued by Temple University Press. Dr. Conlogue is a native of northeastern Pennsylvania. He has taught English at the university level for a number of years, and he is the author of Undermined in Coal Country, On the Measures in a Working Land, Here and There, Reading Pennsylvania's Working Landscapes, and Working the Garden, American Writers and the Industrialization of Agriculture. Again, his newest book, Working Watersheds, Water and Energy in the Lackawanna Valley, issued by Temple University Press. He goes from the particular, this place, out into the global. For more information, on the web, Temple University Press, tupress.temple.edu, tupress.temple.edu, and Conlogue is spelled C-O-N-L-O-G-U-E.